Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright
lights. We have tonight's guest, neuropsychiatrist and author of the ESP Enigma, Dr. Diane Hennessy.
Night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guests, Sudama, Mark Kennedy, and Steve Miles. I am Mark Leisure, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
A year or so ago, I think it was, a friend of mine, Peter Yundua Hudson, introduced me to the telepathy tapes. Quite emphatically, I might add, that I had to listen to these. And so I started to listen. If you don't know what it is, from their website, it's a groundbreaking podcast exploring the voices of non-speakers and the science of consciousness, connection, and communication. I think it went more viral faster than any other podcast series that I know of, and well deserved, and good on them. Our guest is not only in that series, she inspired it, and she is in the upcoming film of the same subject matter. So in the telepathy tapes in season one, non-speaking individuals with autism reveal striking telepathic abilities that challenge everything we thought we knew about the mind. In season two, the lens widens to extraordinary experiences that invite us to rethink reality itself. That is what our guest, Dr. Diane Hennessy, has been inviting many people to do, and myself included, the more I explored not only the telepathy tapes, but her books and speaking with her and some of her videos, etc., etc. She's a John Hopkins trained neuropsychiatrist, expert on autism and savant syndrome, and author of the ESP Enigma, a scientific case for psychic phenomena, whose work inspired the telepathy tapes, as I mentioned. So Dr. Hennessy draws on decades of research with autistic children and adults whose savant abilities and heightened perception challenge conventional views of mind. She argues these extraordinary capacities reveal not only alternative realities, but also the deeper structure of information itself, postulating that consciousness may be field-like rather than locally generated. So, building on her toroidal field model of the brain, she proposes that the mind can access coherent field patterns, what mystical traditions call the Akashic fields, and so much more. I can't wait to have this conversation. And you know, Mark, you, Dorothy, and I, and for that matter, many of our guests have talked about this kind of thing. As a matter of fact, I think we all talk about this. We say things like, I can't believe it. I was just thinking of you and you called me. Like, what is that?
Well, we've certainly talked about intuition and ESP and synchronicity and coincidences, but we've also talked more deeply. You know, I was involved in field science research years ago, and that and other experiences that we've had with certain autistic friends and members of our community that were multidimensional like. So this conversation tonight, the body of work that Dr. Hennessy and the telepathy tapes and the container that it holds is big enough on its own, but it really does shatter the paradigm across so many aspects of how we thought life was and or what we weren't really allowing ourselves to tap into.
Mm. And, you know, interestingly enough, I like how you said that, because you might recall I used to say, we need to write these down. And I've told people, you write these down. And then finally I said, you write these down to me. Write these down, because what if that is real life? Like, if that's not happening, then it's not real life.
Well, I think the only thing that makes it not real is our denial, because it happens more often than it doesn't. And it's happening so many times around us in ways that we don't acknowledge because we're not present enough to witness it.
Good point. Good point. As a matter of fact, we've titled this episode New Awareness. Hopefully, awareness being the key word here, new awareness. Conscious appears to be field like. Consciousness appears to be field like. This is our episode 881. And our guest is neuropsychiatrist, conscious researcher, consciousness researcher, and author of the ESP Enigma. She's here with us, and we're so grateful. Diane Hennessy, MD. Welcome to the Life Changes Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I know you are appearing this weekend at the Conscious Life Expo. We were told by Donna Schumann, who's the PR public relations person there, that so many people have tried to get you on their podcast. So we're so honored that you actually are on ours and are here to share the information. But also, I want to tell everybody at the top that you will be at the Conscious Life Expo, and we'll talk more about that and how they can come see you in a little bit. So, Dr. Diane, there was a confusion amongst the various people I spoke to as to how you came to this work. And so let's share how that happened, please.
Sure. Thank you. Well, first of all, I became interested in autism back in 1986 when I met Oliver Sacks, who is a neurologist who had written a book titled The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And in that book, he described these two twins, identical twins, who were autistic and so dysfunctional that they were institutionalized. I mean, they couldn't take care of just any, you know, basic needs of their own. And yet they had these abilities to do things that were mind-blowing, such as they could calculate what day of the week any date would fall on for thousands of years back in history and thousands of years forward in history. And they weren't really, it's called calendar calculation, but they weren't really calculating it. They just knew the answer. You could say any date and they just say, oh, that's a Thursday or that's a Friday. But what really shocked me was that they could tell you prime numbers, which are numbers that are only divisible by themselves and one, in 20 digits. And at the time, computers could only do it to 12 digits. Mm. And they were accurate. They were validated to 12 digits, and then they exceeded the computational capacity. And what they said was is that they didn't just, once again, they didn't calculate it. They just saw the answer. The answer just appeared to them out there in what we think of as physical reality. And so that is just one of many savant skills that are accepted by science, where we know that people can know things, and that yet we don't know how they know them. I mean, there are these cases of people that could speak foreign languages that they'd never been taught, or they could play music or create art, and they'd never been trained to do these things, or solve mathematical problems. And yet it's accepted as by scientists because it's reproduced reliably. And so having known that about savants, when I ran into my first patient who exhibited to me that she knew things about me and my future that there is no way that she could possibly know, I thought, well, this kind of reminds me of savant syndrome. I mean, how did they know the things that they knew? And she said she just saw the information out in physical space, just like these savants that Oliver Sacks had reported on said. And so I thought to myself, I bet you that this is basically in the same, you know, that what we call ESP is really another savant skill. And I was already somebody who had obtained expertise in autism. I mean, I went and made that the area that I wanted to specialize in. And so I put that out as a hypothesis, and I wrote my book, The ESP Enigma, in which I really talk about how, science says that these things are impossible, and yet here you have savant syndrome, and on top of that, neuroscience doesn't explain anything. They say that the brain creates consciousness, but how did they haven't proved that, and they can't say how it does that, but they're just convinced that it does. And so what I started to realize is that these gifted individuals could really be sort of the Rosetta Stone that could really help us to understand consciousness in a way that we has been a mystery for centuries.
One thing we could lay to bed right away is non-speaking does not mean non-thinking.
Oh, 100%. I mean, one of the things that I, as somebody who trained as a neuropsychiatrist, what that means is that I'm really I've trained in neurology and psychiatry, and so I understand behavior, cognition, emotions, and the brain. And a lot of what I do is, observation and knowing, what correlates with what. And I could see that these individuals who couldn't speak, but when given the opportunity to have either a keyboard or a letterboard to type what they were thinking, that they were really far more advanced in their cognitive skills than people had given them credit for at all. And just because you don't speak doesn't mean that you're mentally retarded, which was an assumption that a lot of people made. But so many of these individuals are far from that. I mean, many of them would test out into the genius category.
Well, from what you shared earlier, beyond quote unquote normal capabilities
Yes,
in some cases.
absolutely, absolutely. And so it's really become to me, it's become almost like a human rights issue in terms of, we've helped people who are deaf, and we've helped people who are blind, and now we need to help people who have difficulty with the basically it's the sensory motor system that enables them to use their tongue and the rest of their vocal apparatus to speak. But that just because you can't do that doesn't mean that you aren't capable of thinking and taking in a lot of information.
So they may not have sensory motor skills, but they have certain skills that are beyond what we have or what we think we have or what we don't tap into.
Yes.
Where do we fit in there?
So, I mean, one of the ways that I think about this is because I've really given this, I mean, I've been doing this work for decades and I've given it a lot of thought. And I had a real epiphany when I read this book by this Japanese boy who was a non-speaker, and it was translated into English. And he was asked the question, "Why do you jump?" And he said, "I jump because I feel my soul detaching from my body." So he's literally said he was jumping because he was having this out of body experience. And I thought that's really interesting because if you look at the reports of people who have really been studied in like remote viewing by Stanford Research Institute, people like Ingo Swann, or reports like Edgar Cayce, how they describe their ability to get the information is that they go into a trance and they leave their body and they go somewhere else. And this is people who've had near-death experiences talk about this disassociation from their body. And so I thought, And then afterwards, oftentimes people who have had a near-death experience find that they're more intuitive. And so what I started to realize is that we identify with our bodies and the embodied perspective so much as, that this is who we are. And that it's really more like being in a virtual reality game, and our body is our avatar. But we are really not the body. We are something outside of that, that we really have this connection to a higher self that has connection to sort of a unified field of consciousness. I mean, this is, and it took me a long time to get there, but this is really the conclusion I've come to, is that that's really what makes the most sense.
This unified field of consciousness. Now, in one of your writings, you mentioned the Akashic Records. Actually, you're going to be speaking on them this coming Monday. So they're the Akashic Records. I've also, from the telepathy tapes, learned about the Hill, and I know you're going to be talking on that as well, or in the film, I think. So what is there a connection between the two? Are the Akashic Records at the top of the hill? And tell us first what the hill is, or the Akashic Records for that matter,
Okay, yeah,
for those who might not know.
sure, yeah. So in the telepathy tapes, this concept of the hill was really, put out there for the first time to the public. It was something that we heard about from people who were non-speakers or working with non-speakers from different regions of the country without them knowing about one another. And at the hill is a place that's not a physical place. It's a place that the non-speakers say that they go to meet up with other non-speakers, and they describe it as a place that's got a library, just like Edgar Cayce described the Akashic Records as having scrolls that contain all of the information that ever was and ever will be. So, it's like, if you he would go and just basically, if he was doing a past life reading on you, he could grab the record that relates to you and be able to tell you about your past lives or about your health issues or anything about you, because he said it was all in this sort of record. And so the non-speakers describe the hill in a very similar way. And the way that I think of it is that it's not a physical place, but it's a state of consciousness where you have access to all information. It really is the unity consciousness.
So when you say consciousness may be field-like, is that the field?
Yeah, it well it's a part of the field. So the way I would think of it is, think of the field as being like the cloud. Okay. You and I are having this conversation over a Zoom. And the reason why we're able to have this is because, even though I don't know where you are, we're in totally different, different cities, and yet there is an IP, or ID attached to my computer, and so your computer is able to locate my computer through through the internet. We're able to have this connection, and other people are able to join in as well. And think of this Zoom meeting as being like the hill. It's not a physical place, but it's a place where we can all join as separate nodes within this network. So the field is really a network.
What an interesting analogy. So if you were to tell somebody that lived were potentially still alive from the 1800s who didn't know anything about technology, and you said to them, I was on a radio show and we got on Zoom, and they could say, have you met this person, Filippo? And you could say, no, I haven't. Well, how do you know? And so that's what, in a sense, I'm getting from what the analogy you made, that savants are doing, somehow connecting IP, because what I heard from one of the tapes is that they would connect with somebody and it's a real somebody that they've never met and they don't have access to them, right? And then come to find out there really is a somebody on the other side of the planet or America that it was also at the Hill and met them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, so the way that I think of it is, when I was a little kid, my father had a German radio. I don't know if you've ever seen a German radio. Have you?
No.
Okay, well,
but
it was
a transistor, I get it.
German radio was kind of like a ham radio, but it was one of these radios that had lots of dials and lots of, you could get anywhere in the world with that radio. But you had all of these different dials that you had to tune in. Okay. So it was like a radio with multiple dials instead of most of us just have like an AM and an FM, you know, dial for a radio. Well, imagine one with a lot more dials than that, where what you're doing is you're when you're turning that dial, you're choosing a frequency, you know, and each one of those dials is choosing a different frequency. And there's a certain, like a combination lock. You're taking all of those different, you know, tuning into all those different frequencies, and then you're going to find that station, you know, that you want to listen to somewhere else. Similarly, we live in this, each of us is a node in an informational consciousness field, and these savants are really good at just dialing in, you know, where they want to be, you know, whether it's a state of consciousness, like, oh, I'm going to tune into the non-speaker, think of it as the non-speaker station, you know. I'm going to just tune in and, you know, find my buddies there, right?
So what are we missing who are speakers and not savants, as far as I know? What are we missing, or what are we not tuning into or don't know how to use that they either know how to use or it's open for them for some reason?
Well, I think that one of the reasons why it is open for them is I think that we're all born still connected to unity consciousness. And I think that what happens is that as we go through development, we become more and more identified with the body as self. We become more and more identified with the avatar in the matrix, in the virtual reality game. And we lose sight of who we are. And so because the fact that all of the non-speakers regressed very early on in their development, such that their avatar just doesn't function very well. And in terms of, you know, just the physical sort of moving around in this 3D world. And so, you know, they spent a lot of their time in, however, one of them told me that it's 11 dimensions. They spend their time in this more 11 dimensional reality.
Wow.
So we all live, you know, whatever that reality is, let's say it's 11 dimensions, we all live it within that. And the reality is that we all return to that after we die, and we can connect with it, but it's that we bought into this belief that this 3D reality is all there is.
Dr. Diane, I'm listening to you and you're saying reality is, and then you're saying these things which sound kind of woo-woo. Mm-hmm. And to know you are a doctor.
That's right. Well, see, this is the thing. I know it sounds woo-woo, but part of why I was able to come to where I am now within my understanding of things is that think about what physics learned 100 years ago. Physics actually abandoned this three-dimensional view of reality 100 years ago. We had Einstein, whose theory of relativity told us no, time is not linear. It's an illusion to think that time just moves forward, and and to think of it as being sort of a linear means that it progresses at a steady rate. And he in his thought experiments, which were then later, proven that time actually passes at different rates depending upon how far you are away from the Earth. Somebody in a spaceship traveling around the Earth is aging more slowly than we are here. And so the passage of time is not what we experience it. And then we discovered that space is not what we think of it as either. Niels Bohr, and other physicists at the time discovered that the atom is not a like a a ball, like a physical little, marble type structure, that it's actually a wave of probability.
And yet, what you're saying and what you have been saying is, quote unquote, so dangerous or so controversial that you would have your medical license taken away and you would have your book taken off the internet for a period of time?
And that was what, and here's the thing that's kind of sort of, even makes it more shocking is that my book was reviewed favorably by the alumni magazine for my medical school. So what you have is you actually have right now, and I'm doing research now in collaboration with people at several universities. And I'm going to be contributing a chapter about my theory to a book that's going to be published by Oxford. So the reality is that you have people who are serious about consciousness, which for a long time you couldn't study consciousness. I mean, it wasn't considered respectable at all. And so you have a lot of scientists now who realize that the things that I was saying 20 years ago when I wrote my first book, they're realizing that it's correct. And people, and so we're really that the materialist model just doesn't, there's too many things it doesn't account for. It has to ignore way too much. And it's just that they've been waiting for a replacement model because they really know materialism isn't correct. And so actually what I'm saying now is actually being taken quite seriously, even though it sounds very, very woo. Because if you think about it, when I say that we live in this, field, what am I saying? We're living in, think about, once again, go back to the analogy of the cloud, okay? All of that information that's contained there, right? And our computers, our smartphones can tap into it, right? And so what I'm saying is that there is something that oftentimes our technology just mimics nature. And that there is something that's in the natural world that is the equivalent of that. Only the difference is that which is in the natural world contains information that we haven't even discovered yet. The cloud, the artificial cloud, only contains that which we humans put into it.
So the cell phone can tap into the cloud, and we can use the cell phone to tap into the cloud. Savants can tap into the Akashic Records or the Hill or both and and other dimensions and all without a cell phone. What can we use to tap into that?
Well, so here's the thing is that we can actually use our, there's a lot we share in common with these savants. Okay, that's the point I want to make is that our body is full of sensors. Okay. And if you think about, you know, what any of our sensory organs, you know, look at the ears, for example, the inner ear has these hair cells, okay, that basically each one of them picks up different frequencies. Okay. And so there's this membrane that contains all of these different hair cells, and they will start, you know, vibrating and responding to different frequencies. And our brain uses, you know, its computational capacity to detect the signals that are in the vibration in air. Okay. That's mainstream science. Okay. Similarly, there's light, and there's light of various frequencies. And just like sound, not all of those frequencies are detectable by our sensory organs, but we do detect a small fragment of it, and that's the visible light. And it's, once again, these receptors in the back of the eye that pick it up, and our brain decodes the patterns in it. And so what I'm saying is that there's information that is still encoded in waveforms that are vibrational and electromagnetic. It's just that they're outside of the range of those particular sensory organs, but they're actually, we have other sensory organs that can pick up that range. And so we've really underestimated the capacity that we have to detect these signals. If you think about all of our sensory, we have receptors in our skin for light. We have receptors, for vibration. We have receptors. We have receptors for electromagnetism. That we can detect electromagnetism that are in the back of the eyes. We have a lot of receptors that are all about decoding waveforms, and there's information contained in all of these waveforms.
Is using psychedelics or plant medicine, so to speak, is that a cheating? Will that help us get there? Does that serve us, or ultimately not, maybe?
It depends upon the individual. I mean, what I would say is that for some people, they're just so rigidly locked into, because it's very seductive. Our primary sensory organs, our eyes and our ears, it's so seductive that the information that we get from them, for us to just think that that's all there is and to pay attention to that. But the reality is that there is more information. So when people take psychedelics, they will have experiences that are not that dissimilar from these autistic individuals. They'll see auras around things. They might, merge with the other. People on psychedelics report having telepathy. They report a lot of the same things that these autistic individuals do. And I think that it's really that it just breaks down some of the filters, just like these autistic individuals' filters are leaky, and that information leaks in. But there are other people for whom they don't need to take psychedelics. They already have access to this information, and a psychedelic might might be destabilizing, you know. You know, so it's really a matter of what somebody needs, but not everybody needs that. For some people, it's just that they need to know that the experiences they're already having are not a sign that they're crazy. For some people, it's like, oh, I have people contact me all the time that just say, boy, until I, you know, learned about your work, I really thought I was crazy, even though they're able to hold a full-time, you know, job in a professional career, and yet they have these experiences that our model, current model, teaches them that means you're crazy if you have those experiences, and yet many of their experiences are very similar to these savants, and but people will dismiss them because people don't want to. It they've been taught to not trust them or to be afraid of them.
I want to make sure people know you were able to get your medical license back. Good for you. And you also were able to get your book back online, your first one and your second one coming up. So want to know more about the books as we're drawing to a close here. Just briefly about the books.
Yeah, well, sure. So my first book, The ESP Enigma, which is really still very relevant for people that haven't read it, in which I give a lot of evidence for that was really done by scientists under very, very controlled conditions, that really is evidence for all of these different things that we call ESP, you know, whether it's the ability to see things that, you know, see or hear things that are at a distance, or to, you know, have, you know, mind-to-mind transmission of thoughts, or to experience the future before it happens, or a lot of these things, there's a lot of evidence for them. And so I talk about that, and I talk about some of these concepts within physics that really help to make sense of that show that actually this is not these things are not impossible based on our understanding of reality, based on physics. And they're not impossible based on our understanding of neuroscience either. And so that's my first book. And then the book that I'm working on now, Wired for the Impossible, is really to talk about a new way of thinking about how the brain works. And I really do believe that it's not just these savants that are there. Have this ha are wired to have these kinds of experiences. I think we all are, and it's just that we've been conditioned to believe that we can't do it. And everything is something that if you want to become a master at it, you have to believe you can do it and put the time into trying to do it.
I was telling you earlier how you're so soft-spoken and you seem so gentle and so quiet, and yet I feel like there's this loud, maybe it's telepathic message coming through, like we need to get this, like our survival maybe for our civilization may depend on exactly this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because once you really actually understand this new model for reality, and I'm far from the only scientist who believes this. I mean, there's hundreds of us who are scientists who have published in peer-reviewed journals who come around to believing that the materialist model for consciousness is incorrect. So, and the thing is that once you realize that we're all interconnected, you start to realize what's really important in life and how we can't hurt someone else without hurting ourselves. We can't, we everything's interconnected.
Dr. Diane Hennessy, Dr. Diane Hennessy, HENNACY.com is her website, or HennessyInstitute.org is another one of her websites. You can find her all over, of course, the telepathy tapes. You can find links for her at the Life Changes show page. We have a video that she has put out from the Hennessy Institute. And so there, she's all over, but she will also be at the Conscious Life Expo. We'll tell everybody a little bit later how they can get tickets, etc. But Diane, there is a, you're giving a talk this coming Monday, and on Saturday, you have some special guests with you. Could you briefly tell us about them?
Yes. So I'm going to be accompanied by two different telepathic pairs. So I really feel that people need to experience these autistic individuals, and in both cases, it's their mothers, experience that what it is that they can demonstrate to believe it. People hearing it on the podcast, the telepathy tapes, is pretty mind blowing. But then when people actually see it, it's a whole other layer to it. And so I'm being accompanied by Dahlia and her daughter Lidu, who's 15, and she's a very gifted. I mean, she's not only telepathic, but she's very she's just very wise. That they're wise beyond their years. And then a woman named Nancy and her son Alex. And Alex also he's telepathic with her, and he's also wise beyond his years. And we might even see some demonstrations, but I don't know if the mothers themselves have their own psychic gifts. And so I think that for these two particular pairings, you're not only seeing a child who's very, very gifted, but you're also seeing a mother who's very, very gifted as well. And I think that seeing the mother who's gifted might then encourage people to realize that you may have some of these gifts as well.
Dr. Diane, thank you so much for raising the awareness and the hope and for so many, and bringing this conversation to light as you do in your gentle and kind way, and very educative. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you on Saturday, actually, and experiencing myself. What time will that be, by the way?
Oh, I think it's at 10:30, something like that. But don't quote me on that.
Okay, I'll check.
Yeah,
I'll check. Well, all the best to you, and thank you so much. And good luck with the film as well. Please let us know when that comes out so we could share with our audience as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh my gosh, Mark, this is so deep, and it feels like such a teaser, but the series is long. The film is going to go deeper, and there's just so much.
There'll be a time when we look back and recognize that her work and these breakthroughs and the crossing the veil communication will have been one of those major paradigm shifts that is a pivot in, you know, the way we all interrelate and the way we approach life.
You know, and when you say that, it makes me think of, like, what can I do? I'm just one person. Here is one person who is doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this space.
Yeah, such an important topic. And the big takeaway was the multiple times she brought up the interconnectivity.
Yeah.
And because I was thinking about even as we're still trained to think that things are separate, as if the brain is not connected to the gut and connected to the heart. And the fact the heart is always on and our entire biofield is what is exchanging information with the environment. And, you know, when you step on the elevator and you get that feeling, good or bad, you know, that's field. That's your field interacting. So why wouldn't you be able to tap into a different spectrum or a broadband of spectrum one way or another?
Why wouldn't you want to?
very right.
So let's let people know how they can get to the Conscious Life Expo.
Awaken your spirit and expand your horizons at the Conscious Life Expo. Experience visionaries, change makers, and planetary influencers exploring advancements in science, UFO disclosures, spirituality, metaphysics, and healthy lifestyles. The Expo presents provocative panel discussions, interactive workshops, free lectures, special events, live concerts, and a healthy food court. Conscious Life Expo, with over 200 speakers and 350 vendors, and featuring a global array of artifacts and displaying the latest innovative modalities in physics, science, health, and longevity. The Conscious Life Expo celebrates a new paradigm for evolved consciousness with a global following.
Tickets are at www.consciouslifeexpo.com, just like it sounds, consciouslifeexpo.com. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Adam, and I have three very close friends who have all lost their pets 2 weeks ago, and they are still numb with grief, and one is severely depressed. How can I help them move through their overwhelming grief?
Dear Adam, thank you for this important question and for your wanting to assist your dear friends. 2 weeks is still very early in grief. Numbness is normal. Severe waves of grief are normal. What you're witnessing isn't weakness. It's attachment breaking. Numbness is a protective response. The nervous system is buffering shock. So let's remember that losing a pet is not just losing an animal. It is losing a daily companion, a source of unconditional love, a routine, a nervous system regulator, and often it is losing the one companion who felt safest. I believe that being patient with their grief is the first step we need to take. Being willing to listen and encourage them to share their emotions can be very healing. You might also want to help them create a small photo altar, or maybe plant a tree or flowers in the pet's name. As for the friend who is severely depressed, this one needs a slightly different approach. It is important to discover if they're not eating or sleeping and are speaking hopeless language such as, "Nothing matters anymore." If this is what is going on, you might want to suggest a therapy appointment and even offer to go with them. And it is important to know that it is not until 3 to 6 weeks that reality sets in. It has been my experience that's often when the true sadness hits. So please keep showing up. After everyone else stops checking in, that's when you will be able to help the most. And you might want to remind them that grief is proof of how deeply one loves, and love never disappears. It simply changes form.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, you can send her a message telepathically and write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
Well, for our performance segment, we are featuring musicians and artists Sudama Mark Kennedy, Josh Jaffe, and Steve Miles. Of the three, we have Sudama Mark Kennedy and Steve Miles. Welcome, Sudama and Steve.
Greetings.
How good to have you both.
Yes, a pleasure.
And Sudama, little did I expect that when you and I started talking, you told me you're a telepathy healer of all things.
Yeah.
What, like, did we all telepathically plan this or what?
It seems that way. We were all meeting here at the Hill, obviously.
That's right, or someplace. That's brilliant. Oh my gosh, you have a lot to say on the subject, and we'd love to hear it all, actually. But there's also your beautiful music to share. So, unless there's anything brief you want to say about it.
Well, just the thought that, Dr. Diane was speaking about this universal field, and in Australia, they understand that as the dream time, right? Mm. So the Aboriginals go into this altered state, and they connect to these fields of consciousness, right? And in this case, we've entitled the album Whale Dreaming, because essentially that's what's happening from my perspective. I went into the studio with my shakuhachi flute and sitar to sort of engage with them, right? To listen to them, to feel what is it that this 50 million year old ocean consciousness has to express, and how can I respond? And so this whale dreaming was kind of our kind of connection back to the whales, right? Because I've heard people use whale sounds for certain kind of you could say, decorating music, but maybe not so much participating in the music, meaning with them, right? Like singing with them, right? So that was our intention, not to override them, but to sort of really tune into them.
Mm. Well, and this started, well, you've been doing music for a long time, but this started, this series, because you have many, you've got jazz and folk jazz and all kinds of music out there. 12 albums, is it?
Yes. Yeah. The ASMR type approach began with Perfection 44 because my cat purred in B flat and resonating with the center of the galaxy, evidently, which also vibrates in B flat 57 octaves down. And we composed a raga to the cat, right? To at least to the drone of the cat purr. And so that was, we were looking for another project, and it was like, wow, whales, they sing, right? The greatest album of the 70s was Song of the Humpbacks, or at least the most popular new age type album. So anyway, we dove in.
Well, before we dive in and actually hear the music, Steve, according to Sodama, you are the magic man. What do you think he means by that?
Well, you know, music is, in my mind, it's spirit. And there's just a direct connection. And it's all feel.
There it is again, the field and the connection. And I wonder if cats are, if they're purring at B flat. Is that all cats or your cat?
Well, my cat was in B flat, but all cats have a hyoid bone purr frequency that is either 50 hertz, 100, or 150, usually, in terms of the actual frequencies, because those heal joints. Because cats purr because they sleep so much, evidently, and they need to keep vibrating. Whereas dogs don't do it, and they don't have the dexterity of the cat, right? You could drop a cat off a building and it would survive. Not that you'd want to do that.
No.
But it's like a rubber ball, right? Versus like the dog would just absolutely not make it because of their lack of flexibility. But yeah, the purring sort of oils the joints.
Wow. Theirs and anybody who's around?
Ours too. Evidently, medical world is reporting cat purr resonance is freaky healing frequency.
Wow. Now, what about whales? Now, they don't keep a frequency, right? They bend, right?
They're very non-linear in their expression, right? Because they're not singing solfège, but their frequencies are enormous, meaning they're navigating, communicating, mating. You know, if you were in an underwater situation where you couldn't see anything, your telepathic abilities would develop, obviously, in the form of sonar, in this case, right? Echolocation. And so they're able to send beams that sort of bounce off, right? And then it's like how holograms work, actually. But it's an amazing consciousness that they have.
Well, talk about all of us meeting telepathically on this day with Dr. Diane and both of you, Sodama and Steve. We actually tried getting you on earlier at another date, but that couldn't happen on our end, and another one couldn't happen on your end. So here we are on this day, which is not only we had Dr. Diane, but this is the day you dropped what?
Yeah, well, wave navigation is the piece I think you're going to play, right?
Yes, you dropped this piece, and so this is the world premiere on radio.
Yes.
This is exciting. So thank you, whoever orchestrated this, and yes, thank you for bringing it to the show. Anything you want to share about wave navigation besides the fact it's a world premiere here on the Life Changes Show and that this is your favorite song on the album?
It's definitely mine. Steve has the magical ability to make it all fit together, right? Because these are very kind of sonically amorphous things with ocean waves, bubbles, fizzes, screeches, slaps, right? And my stepson Ruben is the mastering genius as well, who made it possible for Reuben Cohen for all of these things to really sound good. Otherwise, the ocean waves would flatten the instruments, right? It would just be too, it's like two-dimensional, everything bumps into itself. But in a 3D holographic, mastered, beautifully engineered situation, you can hear all the parts holographically, and that was the intention. And I think wave navigation fulfills that.
Well, very good. Steve, if you want to add anything to that real quickly.
They're all unique for me. The whole thing is there's a flow to it. And I don't necessarily have a favorite. I think they're all great.
Okay, well, good to hear this one. This is Wave Navigation here, pre-recorded actually, here on the Life Changer Show. Thank you so much.
I think that was Deep Dive, not Wave Navigation, but it's also a great piece.
Ah, was it? Okay. The title on our end said Wave Navigation, but let's call it Deep Dive. Either way, it was a deep dive for sure.
Yeah. You had those whales wailing in the blues. They had that wow, right?
Right. I was going to say, did you bring the cat sound back for a moment?
That's a whale.
That's a whale. Well, that's from the album Whale Dreaming, and that was a world premiere too, I guess. So the whole album dropped today, right?
Yes.
And so yes. Whale Dreaming is available now where music is sold. And there are so many links we have for all of you, actually. You, Sudama, Joss and Steve. And so people can go to the Life Changes Show page and find those. But any one you want to give to invite people to?
Let's see. Joss has incredible music out. Like you said, I have 12 CDs of material. Spotify, I think, has probably the best samplings of everything, Apple Music. So, yeah, and it's free on YouTube. So YouTube doesn't always put it together in a row, right? So it's like you play the song and then that's it, right? Whereas Spotify, it could keep going, right? You wind up on a playlist or something. But
I think to be a musician, you almost have to have an interesting life, or an interesting life also might, there's a corollary there, might make for a interesting musician. Your life, Sudama, I think is up there as one of the most interesting so far that I've heard. And in a nutshell, your dad was a hostage in Iran. You've been in four wars, and you and your family were running from the Muslim mobs. What country was that, by the way?
Well, actually, that was me when Mrs. Gandhi was shot in India.
Oh, that was you.
But in Yemen, we had to flee because the imam, the head of the country, had been burned in his palace, and you know there was the revolution of 61, I believe it was my dad's first post.
Oh, so you were just a kid?
I was 4 years old.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
You started young. Wow.
I mean, there's crazy stories there. My mom went to play tennis with the imam, and then she couldn't because there was four heads on poles.
Oh, wow.
It's another culture. It's like fourth world over there.
Wow.
But yeah, it's been quite a ride.
And speaking of cultures and quite a ride, you've been to quite a few countries and not just like traveled as a tourist. You've lived there. Right. Your dad was a diplomat. So name a couple of the countries that were most influential.
Well, Lebanon, we were there when I was 1 year old. My dad was studying Arabic at Shimlan, which is, if you're in the State Department and you wanted to learn that language, that's where you would go. And then there was a revolution. The Druze militiamen were taking over things, and we had to flee by boat. The U.S. Marines loaded my parents' Volkswagen onto a barge, and I was sent home on a KLM flight with the stewardess. Wow. But that was 58, and then back to New York. And then we went back to Lebanon when was it, 65. And then we were there for the 67 war, where we were evacuated. There's when you live in the Middle East, things flare up fast, and it's very dangerous. So we had our share of that.
At least it was at the time, and hopefully won't be for long if it still is, obviously.
Right, yeah. Right.
But a couple other countries?
Greece. We lived next door to Papandreou, who was the prime minister. In Kastri, which is north of Athens. There was also another military coup then that sort of sent us packing.
I'm sorry, I don't mean that.
Yeah, wherever my dad goes, things catch fire.
Wow. And this was all in a day's work for your dad? Pretty much. Actually, that was his job, right? Oh, my gosh.
He was a consular officer. Yeah. And
wow. What about your fun experiences in some countries? Australia, that must have been fun.
Well, Australia was great to visit. I connected to people who connected me to didgeridoos and experiencing the dream time, essentially, like what that all means, and hanging out with people who are Aboriginal and taught me how to play the didge. And it's a remarkable country there. You feel this connection going back 50,000 years there that I didn't feel here. The Aboriginal waveforms, the cloud, as the Dr. Diane spoke of, is very present. At least I connected to it there somehow. And yeah, and in India too is a whole nother reality.
Go on.
I learned sitar and tanpura, and Indian music has always been one of my favorites. I'm a drone man. I like how music can rise up out of the infinite and dissolve back into it. And that's kind of what the whales' sounds are like, right? They're coming out of this oceanic bed, and they rise and fall. It's like they cascade, and it's very, like I said, nonlinear, and it has shapes, and it's the same kind of reality that the ancient Hawaiians, if they were lost between islands, you know, maybe had gone way out to sea to fish, they could find their way back by the shapes of the waves, right? They know how the wave rolls, how the wind rolls off it. You know, they can tell everything from the wave navigation. And whales are doing that in different ways, right?
So you started off singing, folk singing, playing guitar, and then you picked up different cultures and music and instruments along the way. Australia, the didgeridoo, and then you just mentioned in India and in Japan.
Yeah, I lived there. That wasn't a State Department post, but I taught English there for a while in the mid '80s as a way to just sort of experience the culture and, you know, and study music. And I studied shakuhachi flute with John Neptune, who's American master. And
and that's in the album.
That's on the album. Yeah, the tradition of the shakuhachi is that it came from China, and it was absorbed into sort of spiritual cults, or they had the komuso monks, who would wear baskets over their head and show up at your door and blow zen. And that's what the shakuhachi is designed, not to so much play pretty melodies, although it can, but literally to this ASMR, like these unusual sounds of wind and air. And it's an incredible instrument.
If people go to the Life Changes show page where we feature you, they can see you holding, that's the flute you're holding, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Wow. Well, Steve, is there anything you want to contribute about making this album, gathering the sounds or from the whales and what have you, the waves and all that? What was that experience like?
Well, the cool thing is we had a lot of sounds to start with. We had so many sounds that they got delineated by the type. And so one of the songs is beluga whales, blue. Another one's blue whales, humpback whales,
wow,
orcas, fins. So the tracks are somewhat delineated by the types of whales. There's a dolphin track as well. A couple of them, they're mixed up a little bit, but the coolest thing was that, you know, we would just, I would just take some of the sounds and kind of gather them and put them up there. And then when we started composing music to it, miraculously or whatever, some of the whale sounds were the perfect melodies in the perfect spot, where the music was seemingly random.
Or telepathically, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. it very much so. And that was probably the most interesting element, the fact that there are so many different types of whales, and that as the pieces got composed, a lot of those sounds just magically were there where they were supposed to be.
Well, and thank you for that, and thank you both and all three of you for putting this all together in such a beautiful way. We're going to get to hear Super Pod. I'm assuming that's a pod of whales.
That's dolphins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then here than anything
else. This is a very ecstatic track. Yeah.
I was going to say it's my favorite, and I'm wondering why I maybe resonated with the only dolphin song. Right,
it's true.
Well, interesting. Okay, anything else we need to know before we play this?
Let's do it.
Okay, here is Super Pod on the Life Changes Show. That's super pod. They sounded like they were having fun. You all sound like you were having fun.
Oh, yeah.
And we're having fun listening. So that's from Whale Dreaming. And Whale Dreaming is available where music is heard and purchased. Find it. And, of course, we have links at the Life Changes Show page for not only the album, we have a video, and we also have links for each of their pages. That's for Sudama, Mark Kennedy, and Steve Miles, and Joss Jaffe. And with that, I've had a whale of a time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank so you.
Same.
Thank you both so much.
All the
best to you.
Thank and you.
Look forward to more coming from your camp.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you.
And with a big thank you once again to Sudama, Mark Kennedy, and to Steve Miles. And another big thank you to our interview guest, Dr. Diane Hennessy. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeune, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, and telepathically, I'm sure we all did together, here, I'm here to remind you that as your life changes, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.